emits through a 15 psi, and you're compressing it approximately 12 to 1 prior to ignition. So 12 times 15, well, we're close to 200 psi before you've even ignited it.
Okay. So wouldn't 1,000 be a reasonable pressure when being ignited?
Again, wild guess, gut feeling. I'd say more like 2,000 to 3,000, but yes, in the ballpark, yeah. But those numbers all sound low, and saying 250 psi really rattled me. Although it's possible, I'll tell you why. When you're at idle, you're only letting air in at about 2 psi. So at idle, it might only be hundreds of psi even burning.
Yeah, that's why I premised it under a light load. So for actual getting the work done, I would think it would be closer to 1,000.
All right, because remember, you have the piston rings that have to block that. They do reach a little bit, but you can't just have the gas blown by the piston.
Okay, you know, when I have time, I'll kind of deep dive into the internet and see if I could find other things. The problem with the internet is a lot of times the first entry, for whatever reason, ends up being cut and pasted other places on the web and then repeated endlessly. That's why sometimes I really like finding a technical puzzle where the answer, the first answer to the puzzle on, if you try Google, gives you the absolutely wrong answer. So Google is not perfect. Nothing is perfect. So this too could be problematic. Again, I think there's a lot of kind of range depending upon if it's idling or if it's actually doing significant work and whether it's designed for high performance or kind of mediocre performance.
WS2S.
Yes, Paul recognized. By the way, Ken was in the chat room and is in the chat room and mentioned that the first entry is usually sponsored. And I agree in some cases, yes, but usually they're labeled as sponsored, and this isn't. So when you give them a subject where apparently there's not a heck of a lot that they're going to, they could throw advertisements at you, they don't really do that. So this page, if you type in pressure in one cylinder engine, apparently their AdSense can't kind of do anything. Assuming that they still label things as sponsored, which is my understanding.
S2N was trying to say something.
Paul, please, what do you want to say?
Back in the old days, that 327 engine, you know, it was a Chevy. The compression ratio was 14 to 1, so, you know, 1 was atmosphere, so you multiply that and wind up with a couple hundred pounds. And that would be top dead center. You know, you would, to check your cylinders, you took the plugs out, you put the pressure gauge in each one, and if they all came out roughly the same, you were okay. You didn't blow a seal or something or a ring. But back to you, Roy.
Hold on. Paul, I saw a Chevy 327 on Friday.
It's probably my old one. it was great. I had an Impala, put a Harley on there, for the carburetor, and still exhaust all of it. It was great.
No, this is from a 66 Corvette with a 327 with a Harley 4 barrel.
Yeah, that's why I had a Harley 4 barrel on mine as well. And then I used an Edelbrock aluminum block manifold, and used to go out and play at National Speedway. Remember that place? I missed that, Ed.
The manifolds, are they Edelbrock or Edelbrock? I know it's the letter E, but I think it's almost pronounced like an A.
No, with an E. Edelbrock. That's the way we pronounce it. Edelbrock.
Well, I never bought one like you did, so I defer. Back to Roy.
Okay, very good. So, Wesley, anything else on the subject?
I think we beat. Well, maybe just a few words, and then we go to another subject. Uranium 235 is on the third on the list of the energy density table. So, and of course, it's the isotope. I wonder if this is why nuclear bomb was made from that.
Well, yes, that and plutonium. Both of them are fissionable materials. They will emit neutrons and split. And if you get them close enough together, the neutrons decaying from one will activate the decay of others, and you have a runaway explosion. So you just have to keep it at a critical mass for a finite amount of time, and you'll get a thermonuclear explosion based on fission instead of fusion. It's the nuclei are unstable, and they will split into two other elements and lose some of the binding energy of the original isotope. That binding energy converts to energy, it's a pure thermal energy, heat and such, and you get a big boom. Hydrogen bombs with fusion have more energy density when they explode per mass than fission, but you need something to trigger the fusion. So the clever people made a fission bomb and focused it into an implosion of hydrogen to produce the necessary physical state for hydrogen to fuse into helium, and again losing binding energy, which goes to thermal energy, and an even bigger boom.
Okay. When the hydrogen is called metallic hydrogen, and why?
Well, you know, we had that discussion a while ago about the metals, and in terms of chemistry, metals are different than in terms of astronomy. In astronomy, everything but hydrogen and helium is considered a metal. But in chemistry, if metals have certain qualities, they have a diffuse electron cloud that allows for conduction. And also different electromagnetic qualities. They tend to mirror images, reflect them instead of absorb and then rescatter them. So there are certain qualities that are seen in metal states that are not seen in other states. If you can bring hydrogen down to enough of a temperature, low temperature, and a very high pressure, it will go into a metal phase and have the behavior and qualities of other metals.
WS to land, just a quick comment, right?
Certainly, Paul.
I looked it up, and these Edel Brock manifolds are expensive as ever. But, yeah, it's with an E, E-D-E-L-B-R-O-C-K. Boy, I haven't looked this up in many, many years. Big money, big money. Back to you.
No, I'm just wondering about the pronunciation. We always read on the spelling.
Oh, maybe you did. I'm a bad speller. I had to double check it.
Well, you know, there are always places like Kosciuszko and Kosciuszko where people can have fights about it.
Yeah, that's a good one. So Kosciuszko is Americans use. Kosciuszko is when American is trying to say it like Polish would say. And Kosciuszko is the real last name of Kosciuszko. Kosciuszko. I'm not sure you would be able to repeat it to Roy. Kosciuszko.
Speaking about New York City bridges, my mother always said it's the Shortles Bridge. Everybody mispronounces that one.
Yeah, I mean, the usual understanding, if it's a public thoroughfare or such, people are going to just name it whatever they want to pronounce it the way they want to pronounce it. In some fields of expertise, people try to use the pronunciation that it originated. Like, you could tell the difference between someone really into optics and someone not really interested by whether they call it a Fresnel lens or a Fresnel lens. And there's a lot of names that we've changed the pronunciation for the units of measurement and such that they've gone on to be used in. So sometimes people use the right name. A lot of times they use the wrong pronunciation for that name.
Okay. So one property that you can mention for metallic hydrogen is the phase of hydrogen in which it behaves like electrical conductor. So that phase was predicted in 1935 on theoretical grounds by Eugene Wigner. There was another guy, Hillard Bell Huntington, yeah. But anyhow, that would be it. I think Paul is more interested with hydrogen. Enter XJN.
Okay. I sort of mentioned it was a conductor. I didn't say it was a conductor, but I mentioned that metals have electron fields, dislocated, non-fixed electrons that are able to be moved to every which way, which is really how electrical conduction works.
And okay, that would be it. There are plenty of other things serving as a fuel. Hafnium. I didn't even think about if hafnium. There would be beryllium. Or beryllium. Beryllium is absolutely dangerous. But it's not dangerous. I hold the beryllium in my hands. Beryllium is dangerous only when it's broken, right, and you inhale it. So beryllium plus oxygen will be 23.9, so it's even less than the gasoline is or the hydrogen is. But anyhow, thank you very much, and let's go to another one.
That's the one I doubled before.
Yes, Paul.
You know, Wesley talks about liquid hydrogen under high pressure could become a conductor. I remember this conversation years ago, and it has to do with Jupiter. And, you know, inside the core of Jupiter, they say there's hydrogen, and the pressure is so strong that that's exactly what happens. And that's one of the reasons that they have that planet gives off a terrific magnetic field, you know, which reaches all the way to Saturn. You know, it's an outrageous magnetic field, and it's a spinning planet. Every 9 hours it goes around, so you have like Earth, you have the metallic core creating the magnetic field here with the spinning Earth. On Jupiter, it's liquid hydrogen, creating that, it's got an electrical field in it. So I remember that conversation on this net years ago. Back to you.
Yeah, it's a fascinating field. There's a lot of research going on. There's this guy on YouTube. Usually he doesn't talk about his research. He's a research chemist by training and by profession. He tends to take on the claims of different gadgets that people are trying to get people to invest in that are just scams. The guy's name is, I think his name on YouTube is Thunderfoot. And he has published a couple of videos of his work with metallic hydrogen, which is kind of fascinating to watch him produce it in an enclosed space. So it is fascinating. It acts like a metal. It acts like it's a liquid for the most part, at least in the pictures I've ever seen. So it acts a lot like liquid mercury. It has the same mirror sheen that mercury has, and it has a, I don't know if it's a superconductor. It may very possibly be, but I don't remember. But it certainly is a conductor. I don't know if it gets to be a superconductor under those situations. Okay, so I guess we talked about this as much as we could talk about this. Anyone else with any topics for discussion, any questions, any comments, please hit that push-to-talk button, give us your first name and call sign. Okay, maybe you guys need a little breather. I will pull out my little puzzle I mentioned a while ago, discussing ChatGPT, that I was able to coerce it somewhat into a puzzler for us. I pretty much had to feed it some of the information, but it came up with a reasonable one. But before I give you ChatGPT's puzzle, I'll give you a little bit of a primer on the basic subject. I brought up the subject with ChatGPT of neutron stars. Neutron stars, I find to be very, very interesting. Most stars are big balls of hydrogen and some helium, undergoing a fusion reaction, producing more helium and a lot of energy, which is radiated out. Big enough stars can move on from fusion of hydrogen to fusion of helium to produce heavier elements, and that could fuse to heavier elements. And stars can theoretically fuse all the way up to iron before it stops being an exothermic reaction that releases energy and becomes an endothermic reaction. So stuff like lead and gold and uranium and all those real heavy atoms can be produced in the heart of stars. They tend to be produced during explosions, when a star goes nova, when stars collide, when neutron stars collide, when black holes collide. That's when the energy necessary to produce heavier atoms of things like gold produce gold. I'm going to jump for a sec.
Can I say a point?
Certainly, yes.
Carl Sagan says every atom in our body is the product of a star nova explosion.
Well, I would be a little finicky and say that that is certainly the case for everything but hydrogen. You could make a case that the hydrogen got there because it exploded out of an exploding star, and it didn't really convert it into anything. It just moved it from one place to another. But all of the elements heavier than the hydrogen were produced as a consequence of either a star burning or a star or remnants of stars colliding and exploding and failing and such. So, I would put that little footnote off to the side, just me being me.
I agree.
Okay, I mean, that's where that great phrase, "we are all made of star stuff," comes out. And I love the imagery. And truly, a lot of our elements, other than hydrogen, were created in the core of suns and exploding neutron stars and all kinds of fun stuff. So it's nice to know that our body had a real exciting life before we took the materials over. And also, it gives you a kind of weird existential problem that, approximately every 7 years, most of your atoms are replaced by other atoms. So are you the atom, or are you a soul, or are you an intellect? And what really constitutes you or me?
Wait, I have something off topic.
Sure, we can go off topic for a while. What is it?
thinking about something. You might think it might be something interesting here. Everybody heard about that disastrous train wreck last week in East Palestine, Ohio, which is the town name. But in any event, I know quite a bit about that from some work I did back about 20, 30 years ago, having to do with, quote, hot box detectors.
Okay.
Does anybody want a 3-minute lecture on the who, what, why, when, and where of hot box detectors and what the fiasco was last week?
Yes.
Sure, feel free, Ed.
Back in the day, in the early days of trains, the wheel axles had wheel bearings, which was a bronze sleeve. And by the way, car crankshafts today use oil immersed bronze sleeves as the main crankshaft bearing. And what they did was they had bronze sleeve bearings in a journal box with a little hinge cover, and the box was full of something called waste, which I think is basically hemp or manila fiber like they use in serious ropes, which kind of absorbed the oil and kept it from sloshing around. And I remember in the day seeing the old cowboy movies where the train is in town and the engineer's walking up and down the length of the train with an oil can. What he's doing is he's topping off the oil in the journal boxes. And if a journal box ever ran dry, the bearing would overheat. And in a term called a hot journal box, or hot box for short, and if carried to an extreme, it could catastrophically fail and derail the train. Okay, so far, right?
Yep.
Well, around by the 1920s and 30s, when trains were becoming, you know, much more serious, heavier, faster, longer distances, hot boxes were becoming a real problem. Because remember, if you have a bad wheel bearing, say on your car, you will hear it, you will feel it. In the middle of a mile-long freight train going through the cornfields of Nebraska or Kansas, you can go a long distance before anyone hears it. So it was becoming a problem. But after World War II, the government declassified a lot of work that they're doing on infrared and infrared sensors. And a lot of people jumped onto this, and they started using track-side-mounted infrared sensors that would be bolted to the track just outside, you know, in other words, you have the two rails, and these would be on the outside, not the inside. On the outside, but the bearings are outside of the wheels. And it would look up at the passing bearings going by overhead, and it was lined up, that would look right up. And, of course, they had to be careful not to mistake the sun overhead from a passing wheel bearing and all that. But they developed systems where they had track-mounted systems that would detect a hot box going by. Let me drop it. The main problem, then, is, okay, what do you do about it? How do you tell the crew there's a problem? And they developed another primitive tape because the technology improved. We got more and more sophisticated. That made it simple. You just had a synthesized voice to give a report. And what they also had was axle counters. Now this would go on the inside and would detect the passing wheel flange. In other words, the sensor would be bolted to the web of the rail so the wheel flange would pass right over the center. And it was like a little generator. It was a coil and a magnet. A massive steel went over it to generate a pulse. So the radio was mentioned like there could be a hot box right side, actual 128. And then they drop on off the next page. Then they started going from journal boxes to tapered roller bearings, primarily originated by Timken. They never used ball bearings. They went straight to roller bearings. And I've seen these roller bearings, and they are about a foot in diameter, a foot long, you know, weigh like 150 pounds. These are serious bears. But in any event, when they came up with these, I figured, all right, that's the end of the hot box. There's a hot box to take the business, is going to dry up. And lo and behold, they found out these are permanently lubricated for life. What's life? Sooner or later, they wear out, and it turns out they actually would get hot faster than a journal box, and they had to mount these sensors instead of every 35 miles, every 25 miles. So it was a boon to the business. And that's kind of why it's called. And so this is what they had. Now let's come to today. We're actually there. When I heard about this, I said, oh my God, that sounds just like a classic burn-off, I.D. and over-the-air battery cell. I said, but what happened? Every railroad has hot box detectors now. What went wrong? And I heard the other day. Apparently, Norfolk Southern Railroad got the brilliant idea, shades of BP-34 Horizon, to save money by not doing maintenance on these systems. What can possibly go wrong? Roy?
Yeah, well, once again, it's a big business trying to make an extra nickel someplace on someone's life. I don't know, but, you know, I don't mind greed in a controlled way. It kind of motivates people sometimes to do their best. But I don't know. We're living in a weird time where I guess it's kind of musical chairs, and they're waiting for the music to end, and they've kind of given up. It's just the idea is you squeeze the last nickel out before you get arrested or something. I don't know what's going on with everyone. It's you know, it's kind of everyone should have one of those old long mustaches that evil guys in silent movies used to wear.
What, should I review the 2010 D4 Horizon fiasco?
Yeah, sure.
Apparently, some very, very smart people said, if you are drilling in deep water, you need something called the blowout detector sitting on the ocean bottom where the pipe goes, you know, where the drilling and all that goes through it. And these things cost millions of dollars, and they need to be maintained. BP has their drilling rig, the Deepwater Horizon, in the Gulf of Mexico, with a flow architecture that they paid millions for. And then when the stuff shows, like they were getting bits of rubber in the stuff they brought up from the drilling process, which is a flashy sign of a specific problem with the blowout protector, and then they decided not to shut down drilling and repair it. And then there were successive things like this, where they found successive things where the blowout protector was rapidly failing in multiple areas, and they chose to do nothing until they reached the point that there was a blowout, killed like 12 people, seriously injured another 12 as a minimum, as damaged them emotionally for life. It was one of the biggest environmental disasters in history. And so far, I think it's worth something like $50 billion. How's that for Pennywise and Pound Foolish? And now apparently, Norfolk Southern tried to outdo them at their own game.
Yeah, I don't kind of understand it. I think greed has become the overwhelming mode for a lot of companies. You know, I mean, I think Boeing cut corners, leading to some of their problems with their most recent plane disasters. So I think that this is a trend. I think, unfortunately, it's a combination of things. In the last 10, 20 years, government regulation of industry has gotten a bit laxer and laxer, and industry has kind of decided that it's going to go for double or nothing or something. I don't know. I don't know how to interpret some of this stuff. It strikes me as not terribly smart on their part, in the long run at least.
You mentioned Boeing, hold on. Shortly before COVID, after this happened, I was fascinated, I studied it. I actually gave a professional engineering presentation to CU Reddit on that very subject of the Boeing 737 MAX 8 fiasco. Want me to give you the Reader's Digest short version?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we discussed it a year or two ago, but the latest, greatest version of it, sure.
For 100 years, yeah, Boeing started in 1920. For 100 years, Boeing said, we love airplanes right. If you don't want to pay what it takes to get an airplane built right, go buy your airplane somewhere else. We don't owe that way. Well, along comes the 737 MAX 8. And all of a sudden, what happened was Boeing had recently acquired McDonnell Douglas, which had folded because of management, taking shortcuts and this and that. And it's almost like, rather than Boeing taking over McDonnell Douglas pushed away Boeing and they became in charge, and then it became rife. The same thing, and what happened was they started cutting corners left and right. Now, let me use 30 seconds. The main problem, the one that caused the problem, was the so-called angle of attack sensor, which is basically a wing vane. If you ever seen a little, weather center with a little, anemometer that spins and the wing vane that it points into the wing, that's all it really is. It tells you which way the wind is blowing. As Bob Dylan said, don't need to be a weatherman to know which way the wind is blowing. And the problem is they're right to impact failure. So they have two of them on a plane. And Boeing's software people came up with a brilliant idea. Rather than having redundancy like they do with everything else in aviation, even in cars these days, dual brake systems, for example, instead of having redundancy, they just would use one of them. And what was happening is one of them probably hit something and broke, and the system just ran amok. There were no checks and balances. The system that was designed for a problem that only happens at high altitude cruise could not be enabled when you just took off that it was. There's a whole pile of stuff like that. But here's my point. There was no reason why that fix should have taken years. There's only one explanation. They started looking into it with a fine-tooth comb, and every rock they overturned had rocked. They practically had to redesign the plane, and it took them several years, right?
Yeah, I got the idea about that. Not even just the hardware, but the software was rotten as well. There was a lot of work supposedly needed to be done with the software, because it wasn't just the redundancy that was the problem. It was how the software dealt with the failure mode. It's probably the most dangerous reaction you could have for the software to deal with it. So it was a collection of stupid decisions on Boeing's part. It's unfortunate. You kind of assume that everything is going to stay the same in this life, and it seldom does. And occasionally that does happen, where a big company eats up a small company, and because the small company is failing, and somehow the small company gets control of the big company and ruins it. So it's a very strange aberration of big business that happens occasionally. Now, this is not the first time.
And by the way, there's another point to that one in particular. I assume that's a go-ahead.
Yes, certainly.
All right. Everybody in the aviation industry hates dealing with the FAA. Of course, the FAA is very much sticklers, and they drive everybody crazy over details. And Boeing was able to use political clout, yet the FAA let them do their own certification that was normally the FAA's purview. Now, this was a God-given miracle. Here's the way to show that they don't need the FAA, they can do it fine, and they don't need to put up with the FAA and that PKU nonsense. So just show, do it right, show the FAA, see we really can do it, and then there would be a blessing for the whole industry. But no, they acted like a batch of high school kids sitting in the back throwing spitballs, and they did the exact opposite. And now, from now until the end of civilization, the FAA is never going to fall for that one again.
I think in this case, Ed, you're being a little bit too optimistic. People have very short-term memories. People will forget this. People forget everything. It's one of the reasons why history keeps on. You know, you can say that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. The reason is that people, the lessons learned during the Depression, the lessons learned World War II, they're a distant memory. They're in history books. Most of the people who suffered through those times have shuffled off this mortal coil. So I wish you were correct. I don't think so. I think people, there will be calls for deregulation probably next week. It's the give and take, the tug and pull between very, very wealthy businesses that are financing a lot of our present politics these days.
I understand your point. In general, I agree. You just don't know how bullheaded the FAA can be when they let their minds do it.
Okay, but unfortunately, they can only do whatever the Justice Department kind of lets them get away with doing. If from the top down, everyone kind of wants to deregulate everything, you can pull the teeth of any agency. There have been, the IRS has most of its teeth pulled today. And there are other agencies that are waiting at the dentist to have their teeth pulled.
I understand your point, although I think the flying public might have a vote in that.
I hope so. And my hope is that we have an educated populace that understands reality. We have people on YouTube who don't believe that jet fuel makes jets run. And there's too many people who aren't quite sure how anything works. So I kind of despair at the educational level of many of our citizens, even for their own self-interest. One would think that self-interest would go very high. But if you don't have any idea how anything works, you can't really focus your self-interest on anything effective. And I think that's one of the many problems. And the education system that we have talked about before on the Technical Men is part of the problem. And I don't think anyone's really addressing it. They're addressing other aspects of it, which is, to me, kind of semi-meaningless. Critical thinking, understanding things, understanding how everything works, I think is growing more important in this industrial and technological age. And I don't think the educational system is really doing that.
I have a comment about that. By the way, WD3AB.
And I'm AC2GS. Yes, certainly yes.
When I was a kid, there were two groups of students, Michael. There were those who were interested in the world and wanted to learn about it, and those who weren't. And the further we went along, we branched off further, and the ones who were interested in the world became the successful, and the ones who weren't became the drones. The classic definition of a drone. I don't think they were, you know, autonomous flying vehicles. You know, a drone historically was, somebody almost like the human version of a machine. And here's the problem: 57 years later, we're still where we were. I am active in the Boy Scouts. I make no bones about that on the receiver. And I meet a lot of kids as they go to middle school and high school. And you see it. It's the same bifurcation. Those who are interested in the world and want to learn about it, and those who just go through life in the fog. And I will tell you, in the Boy Scouts particularly, the ones who are interested in the world become fine young men and now women.
Okay, I agree with you. There are kind of self-starters to a degree, and there are people who you can't get to care about anything. But I tend to think that depending upon your educational experiences, your experiences in general, some types of situations can feed those people with the early curiosity. It is not that difficult to take someone who has an innate curiosity about how everything works and ruin it by browbeating them and insulting them and isolating them and making fun of them for caring. Whereas occasionally, if you're very lucky, you come across a mentor, sometimes a teacher, who opens up a subject to you. I know I have teachers that I still keep in my mind, have a great deal of respect, and have certainly influenced me. And I'm sure there were people who did that for you, too. And I've also had teachers that just made me upset and annoyed with the subject so much that it lessens my curiosity of it for a long, long time and kind of dampens my enthusiasm. So I think there are innate people who are more interested and less interested, but I think you can improve those who have the inclination, or you can inhibit them.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And also, a bad teacher can be a horribly corrosive influence, 100%. I have a relevant story there. Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Okay.
For those who may not know who Neil deGrasse Tyson is, a young black kid from the Bronx, fascinated with science, especially astronomy. He was one of the ones interested in the world. And he was getting pushed back at every step of the way. But it never was blatant. Black guy, you know. But it was never in your face, your hatred, racism. It was always low expectations. I mean, it was more a matter of trying to protect him from what they've seen happen to others. And he basically just kept plugging away. He gets knocked down, he picked himself up, and he kept plugging away. And now he's one of the world's leading astronomers.
Well, he's a science populist. He really doesn't do any research. I read his PhD thesis. I don't think he did a lot of research beyond that, maybe a little bit here or there. But his claim to fame these days is publishing and showing up on podcasts, YouTube, and television, and cable and such. So he's presently sort of a more of a science popularizer than he is a research scientist these days.
I have to respectfully disagree. Are you ready?
Sure, feel free.
He is the proof that if you don't give up and you keep plugging away, you can prove them all wrong. And that goes far more than science.
Okay, I agree with you. A lot of people are doubted, and some people succeed. We don't really hear the stories of the guys who didn't particularly have the talent, and were told that they didn't have the talent, and ended up never getting anywhere and wasted their time, because that doesn't make for good stories. But, the judgment of other people is just as faulty as any other aspect of humanity. People assess other people not terribly accurately. And so, I'm glad that he accomplished what he accomplished. He tells the story of visiting Carl Sagan up in the college, Cornell, I believe, and Carl Sagan signed a paperback book and gave it to him, and he's doing a good job popularizing science, and he's making a good living, which is good for him. But look, you have to kind of believe in yourself. If you can't believe in yourself, then even if you are great, you will never accomplish anything. So the trouble is, occasionally there's people with delusions of grandeur who think that they're much better capable of doing things than they are. So those are unfortunate cases. But, yeah, you have to believe in yourself, I think, is the A to Z of it all. And work hard. And have pride in what you do. There's too many people who have lost the pride of what they do, what they accomplish. They just want to get by. They want the day to end, which is a shame. You know, live the day.
Colin?
Yes, Hank?
So I think you're describing the Dunning-Kruger effect of people that have confidence in themselves, perhaps step a little bit beyond their ability because they don't have the experience to really know what they know and don't know.
I have two illustrations of that.
Okay. Let me just say, Dunning-Kruger is kind of an overused example. I think it was Dunning. Disputes a lot of people with the Dunning curves and other things that have been highly popularized. I think what he was trying to introduce is that we all have failures that are based on the Dunning-Kruger effect, that each and every one of us is unable to assess our level of expertise in some fields because of our lack of understanding of those fields. Also, there's a kind of mirror image of Dunning-Kruger effect called the imposter effect, which is a fascinating subject. But go ahead.
Go ahead, who?
Ed, you wanted to say something about what Hank just said. Yes. You, Ed, you said that you have a story about Dunning-Kruger.
That idea. Two cases that happened when my son was growing up. I think he was in the sixth grade. And I don't remember, like, somewhere around middle school. He never was much of an athlete, but he signed up for an after-school program. And it was fine, except we noticed that there were a couple of the kids on his team that they and their father seemed to think that they were so good at basketball that, say, today, we all could rattle off the name of the two classes and white boys from Guyana in the NBA. And you well know that did not happen. The other one is, now, as you mentioned earlier, I have done fundraising. I had my kids enrolled in a program in Garrett, and we're still existing, the youth fundraising. And when they saw it, it was like, he came up with some classmates of his and said, he just cut to the chase. He said, all right, what's the best thing you can do with college students? And he said, distinguished expert. And the kid said, I've never done it, but I'm sure if I did it, I'd make distinguished expert. Right?
Yeah, I tend to consider those people more delusional than Dunning-Kruger. Dunning-Kruger is a little bit more specific about information gathering. The idea being that usually if you take a bunch of people and you ask them to take a test and you ask them what their grade is probably going to be from the test before it's graded, they tend to err on the side of a higher grade. As opposed to if you're playing a sport and you have no coordination, I don't think that's quite Dunning-Kruger. That's just delusional or you know, just making excuses for yourself. So I think that's a more of an old-fashioned, obvious problem. There's a lot of people out there who don't have a sense of whether they have a talent in something or not. This is just kind of expertise. If you lack the you know, there are some people who come to this hobby and they're wonderful people, but they know so little about the technology that they aren't quite able to actually phrase a question yet. So they have to kind of passively soak some information up before they pick up enough of a sense and a vocabulary to know what even the question might be rather than certainly than the answer. So I think Dunning-Kruger is slightly different than than people who just think very highly of themselves general and are delusional. You know, narcissists and such were known about thousands of years ago. Narcissus comes from an old Greek story. Ed, could you get a little bit stronger signal? You're starting to fall into the noise.
I believe it has to do with a fellow looking at his reflection in a pool.
Yes, he fell deeply in love with his own image, and he couldn't take his eyes away from his reflection, and so he starved to death, staring at the still water.
If they had invented mirrors, would that have helped him?
Well, yeah, I mean, the point actually didn't happen, obviously, but the idea is that he didn't realize that it was himself, which sometimes happens with animals. You know, they'll see their own reflection and they'll start to act aggressive towards it, not realizing it's themselves. So I don't know at what stage in humanity mirrors became a thing. I think rather early. I think cognitively at a certain point in your development past about 4 years old, you have a good idea of where you stop, and, you know, reflections are just reflections, you know. It's not like every so often in the old days they had these great comedy routines where there was a person on the other side who was making believe he was a mirror reflection of the first person. And it was a pretty good comedy routine. But I think that's more for storytelling than anything else for humanity.
PhD comment.
Yes, Jim.
I am humored with the thought maybe that SWR is not the reflection of a man.
I certainly hope not, because I know a lot of people who have a 10-to-1 SWR.
Roger that.
If that was you, Ed, I couldn't hear you over the noise, unfortunately. Rotate the antenna a little bit or something. I don't know what to tell you.
That was not me.
Oh, okay. That signal sounded fine. So whoever it was that I didn't recognize because he was all noise, try rotating the antenna if you're talking on a handy-talkie. Come closer to the window if you're inside. Go up a hill if you're in a valley. Not great, all noise. I hope it isn't you, Rich. I can just barely hear you. You're about 95% noise tonight. Okay, I'm sure you'll get that antenna working right. Getting back for a moment to Dunning-Kruger. Dunning-Kruger's kind of been overused. I mean, I enjoyed the concept, and I've used the concept, and I've seen the concept used all over the place. And, again, I think the guys who kind of coined it kind of lost control of it, because it's kind of getting a little bit overused. But the bottom line concept is that we are all guilty of Dunning-Kruger effects, because hopefully no one out there thinks that they know everything about everything. So there are things that we just don't know enough about that we don't know them. And that's kind of at the root of Dunning-Kruger. Imposter syndrome is a very curious mirror image version of that. That's where people tend to project themselves onto other people. It's a lot easier to kind of synthesize the other person. It requires much less brain power. But the price you pay is that everyone you project yourself onto knows everything that you know, because you know it, and they're a projection of you. So you start to think that you're not particularly smart at anything, because everyone knows everything that you know. So that's the imposter syndrome, that people think you're a clever lad or lady, and in fact, you feel as though there's nothing special about you because you perceive everyone around you to be equally intelligent.
What an interesting pile of suppositions. Very interesting.
Thank you, Jim. Yeah, I find all these things really fascinating to talk about, to think about, and to make sense of. You know, sometimes things come into the vocabulary and are kind of overused. One term that I grew to despise is the term gravitas, which has its place. But there was a time where that I was hearing that word way more than I should. So sometimes you can get beat over the head. Another one is thinking outside the box. As much as I appreciate some of the concepts involved, I really cringe whenever anyone talks about thinking outside the box anymore because it was just overused beyond belief.
It's interesting that language and speaking and yakking on a radio or, over a campfire or a bar or whatever is such a useful tool for the human condition. And we utilize tools, words, mostly, and conglomerations of words to throw thoughts around and conjecture on what we think about them. And there seems to be a group of, but there seems to be a faction of humanity that wants to make it very hard to do that. And without words, without meaning, without being able to define something, throw out a concept in the verbal sense, it's so hard to get to the next step.
Casey Tucci, yes, I agree with you, Jip. Language is probably the most fundamental way that we exchange ideas and opinions. And ideas and opinions can be very dangerous for the status quo. There was a time, I believe it was in England, probably most of Europe, they had, before tea kind of took over there, they had coffee houses where people would collect and drink their caffeine-laced beverage of choice and talk to each other and incite each other and propound on things with each other and just make trouble for the government such that they basically shut down as many of the coffee houses as they possibly can. The exchange of information can be dangerous. A free language is dangerous. The best way to control a population is to control the language. That's seen in 1984, where one of the main aspects of the book is that they are about to publish a new dictionary which has removed a significant number of words out of the old dictionary. And their ultimate aim is to pare down the words to a bare minimum so that no one can say anything good or bad about anyone and just follow orders. It's a very interesting aspect of the book that a lot of people don't mention much.
Powerful words you put down. Powerful words. It's an important thing. When you either have a word taken from you or excluded from your vocabulary or revoked, you lose the ability to communicate. It's a tough topic, no doubt about it. But I think it's kind of relevant, particularly since we are engaged at the moment in a communication medium.
Yes, and yet I've had arguments at another club that we sometimes lack a common means to communicate. I make a joke about it in my other club that there are some people who prefer to get their information via email. There are others who want it text through their cell phone. There are others who want it announced on a net. And, I make a joke that ultimately we should all kind of agree on smoke signals or something. So
our expertise is supposed to be in communication, and yet sometimes, surprisingly, we lack the skill to develop a common mode to communicate with everyone simultaneously. The world has become increasingly fragmented in more ways than one.
Perhaps the real